Book 1, Chapter 1 of The Beautiful and Damned. The Beautiful and Damned by F. Scott Fitzgerald. The Victor Belongs to the Spoils. Anthony Patch. To Shane Leslie, George Jean Nathan, and Maxwell Perkins, in appreciation of much literary help and encouragement. Book 1, Chapter 1. Anthony Patch. In 1913, when Anthony Patch was 25, 2 years were already gone since irony, the holy ghost of this later day, had, theoretically at least, descended upon him. Irony was the final polish of the shoe, the ultimate dab of the clothes brush, a sort of intellectual there. Yet, at the brink of this story, he has yet gone no further than the conscious stage. As you first see him, he wonders frequently whether or not he is without honor and slightly mad, a shameful and obscene thinness glistening on the surface of the world like oil on a clean pond. These occasions being varied, of course, with those in which he thinks himself rather an exceptional young man, thoroughly sophisticated, well adjusted to his environment, and somewhat more significant than anyone else he knows. This was his healthy state, and it made him cheerful, pleasant, and very attractive to intelligent men and to all women. In this state he considered that he would one day accomplish some quiet, subtle thing that the elect would deem worthy, and, passing on, would join the dimmer stars in a nebulous, indeterminate heaven halfway between death and immortality. Until the time came for this effort, he would be Anthony Patch, not a portrait of a man, but a distinct and dynamic personality, opinionated, contemptuous, functioning from within outward, a man who was aware that there could be no honor and yet had honor, who knew the sophistry of courage and yet was brave. A worthy man and his gifted son. Anthony drew as much consciousness of Social Security from being the grandson of Adam J. Patch as he would have had from tracing his line over the sea to the Crusaders. This is inevitable, Virginians and Bostonians to the contrary notwithstanding. An aristocracy founded sheerly on money postulates wealth in the particular. Now, Adam J. Patch, more familiarly known as Cross Patch, left his father's farm in Tarrytown early in 61 to join a New York cavalry regiment. He came home from the war a major, charged into Wall Street, and amid much fuss, fume, applause, and ill will, he gathered to himself some $75 million. This occupied his energies until he was 57 years old. It was then that he determined, after a severe attack of sclerosis, to consecrate the remainder of his life to the moral regeneration of the world. He became a reformer among reformers. Emulating the magnificent efforts of Anthony Comstock, after whom his grandson was named, he leveled a varied assortment of uppercuts and body blows at liquor, literature, vice, art, patent medicines, and Sunday theaters. His mind, under the influence of that insidious mildew which eventually forms in all but the few, gave itself up furiously to every indignation of the age. From an armchair in the office of his Tarrytown estate, he directed against the enormous hypothetical enemy, unrighteousness, a campaign which went on through 15 years, during which he displayed himself a rabid monomaniac, an unqualified nuisance, and an intolerable bore. The year in which this story opens found him wearying. His campaign had grown desultory. 1861 was creeping up slowly on 1895. His thoughts ran a great deal on the Civil War, somewhat on his dead wife and son, and almost infinitesimally on his grandson Anthony. Early in his career, Adam Patch had married an anemic lady of 30, Alicia Withers, who brought him $100,000 and an impeccable entree into the banking circles of New York. Immediately, and rather spunkily, she had borne him a son. As if completely devitalized by the magnificence of this performance, she had thenceforth effaced herself within the shadowy dimensions of the nursery. The boy, Adam Ulysses Patch, became an inveterate joiner of clubs, connoisseur of good form, and driver of tandems. At the astonishing age of 26, he began his memoirs under the title New York Society as I Have Seen It. On the rumor of its conception, this work was eagerly bid for among publishers. But as it proved after his death to be immoderately verbose and overpoweringly dull, it never obtained even a private printing.